what's happening in Washington and how it affects you. Melissa in the Morning welcomes Congressman Jim Himes to WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Congressman Himes, it'll be so nice to hear your voice. I think it's been a whole summer. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Doing okay, thank you. Yeah, it has been a while. I guess August and all that, yeah.
Honestly, though, Congressman, yeah, I was going to say, summer season is always kind of wackadoodle. I was away a lot of it. I don't mean to, like, put that on you because it's really not. It's always wacky. So it's great to have you back and looking forward to getting back on schedule with you. And certainly what a time to be speaking this morning. We are following some pretty big news about prisoners overseas with ties to the United States. Talk to us about this. For people who don't know the details, what's happening?
Yeah, well, most people recognize this ugly syndrome that is out there because, you know, the Russians, took that famous woman basketball player. And this one hits close to home because for 5 years now, a wonderful elderly gentleman by the name of Murad Tabaz of Iranian heritage, but U.S. citizen, has been detained in Evin prison in Tehran. Evin prison is about as close to hell on earth as you can imagine. And he was in Iran to do, environmental research around some, lynx-like cats or something that, he's a conservationist and, he was doing research, was arrested 6 years ago and has been just held in brutal conditions for 5 years. That's, by the way, true of four other hostages that we determined were wrongly detained. And the Biden administration, I've been working on this case for 5 years because Murad is from Weston, Connecticut. His family, I've been in almost weekly touch with his family because you can imagine how they've felt over that period of time. Well, long story short, it looks like there will be a prisoner exchange. Five Americans coming home, we hope this weekend, including Murad. And five Iranians who violated sanctions being released. A couple of them are Americans, so they won't necessarily go back to Iran. So anyway, potentially, if this happens, a very, very happy day for Murad's family in Weston. Controversial, as these things always are, Melissa. The deal also involves the release of $6 billion of Iranian funds that have been held in Korea, the release to a Qatari bank. Those funds are restricted to humanitarian use, food, medicines, and agricultural equipment. But, you know, it's a tough one. It's a tough one because you don't like to negotiate with people like the Iranian regime.
Right.
But very focused on the fact, obviously, that a wonderful man is going to be hopefully home in the next couple of days or so.
So let me just get the deal straight. So we are getting five Americans back, hopefully, and we're returning five, like, overseas.
We're releasing five Iranian. A number of them have green cards, so they won't all be going back to Iran. Some of them will stay here. But, yes, it's five for five. And then the unfreezing of $6 billion of Iranian money that has been held in South Korea for a bunch of years.
Is that just because they don't feel that the worth, if I you know, just for a layman's term, do they just not feel that these five for five is not a worthy enough swap? They needed money too.
Yeah, I wasn't in the negotiating room, so I can't tell you everything. These things can be lopsided. You know, the Israelis, for example, who often either have detainees, Palestinian often detainees, you know, have done some pretty lopsided deals of trading, you know, dozens of people for a couple of Israelis. So I think the dynamics of each of these negotiations is different. The important thing here, and look, I'll say right up front that these deals are hard. You hate to have to negotiate with people like the Iranians. But in this case, it is Iranian money that is being returned to the Iranians, not U.S. dollars that are going to them. That's the terms of the deal.
I'm curious, and we're talking to Congressman Himes. You said that you've been working on this for 5 years. I remember when Murad Tabaz was captured, again, because it had Connecticut connections. And I think at the time I was working out of state for another station. But, you know, when you hear Connecticut, it's kind of hard to unhear that. Out of the five that are coming back to the United States, there was one person in custody for a long time. One of the controversies surrounding, you were right, when the basketball player was released, one of the controversies was there was somebody who had been over there for longer than her but didn't have if you, you know, I guess the status that she did. Is he included in this group of five coming back?
Not 100% who you're referring to. I know that these five Americans returning to the United States means that the Iranians no longer hold any Americans except for possibly one. And the guy's name is escaping me. He is, I think, supposedly a former FBI officer. I wish I could remember his name. The Iranians claim not to hold this individual, and I think that there is some sense on the part of the U.S. government that he may be deceased. So the record is not 100% clear, but it may be. Again, there's this one individual whose name I wish I could remember, whose fate is unknown. Apart from that, yes, this would be the return of all of the Americans.
Wow. And you said they could come as soon as this weekend. Tell us a little bit, if you don't mind, from your perspective, Congressman Himes, working on these kinds of deals for years, would you, you know, talk a little bit about kind of the behind the scenes of that? Obviously not the details, because I know you can't, because it's confidential, but, you know, just, you know, talking to this family for the last 5 years consecutively and trying to work out how do we figure out getting this man back safely, and what would be the message, especially for people going overseas? Unfortunately, we have seen in recent years where there's not a lot of forgiveness, and it kind of holds the United States in a bind if people are caught overseas. I guess talk a little bit about both of those, you know, what it's like to go through this kind of a process, getting someone home, but also the message to people if they are traveling to dangerous areas, what the risks are.
Yeah, those are great questions. And the second question is an easy one, you know, and not necessarily my job to tell people what to do. But, you know, if you're thinking about going to Iran, or if you're thinking about going to Russia or North Korea and maybe one or two other countries out there, don't go. Don't go. You know, you don't need to be doing something wrong for the Russians or the Iranians to decide that they want to use you as a bargaining chip, right? Believe me, they'll trump up a charge if they decide that they can gain something by taking an American. And we see this happen all too often, and it's absolutely tragic. And again, there are a bunch of countries where, you know, there is no rule of law, and they'll take you to use you as a bargaining chip. And by the way, again, I said these deals are hard. You always worry that when you strike one of these deals, that's just going to provide a little further incentive for this to keep happening. But we do have some control. You don't need to go. And then in terms of, you know, how these deals get negotiated, they can be really hard. And this gets back to, you know, how did it land exactly where it landed with, you know, the unfreezing of funds and 5 for 5. You know, particularly with the Iranians, where we don't necessarily talk directly to the Iranians because we don't have diplomatic relations with them. Now you're talking to the Swiss, and the Swiss are going to the Iranians, and then they're coming back. You know, the actual exchange of people, it doesn't happen on the ground in Tehran. It's going to happen, as I understand it, in Doha and Qatar, you know, and this involves the Swiss being involved. It's often the Swiss, right, because they're perceived as neutral in many of these instances. And so a lot of these negotiations happen indirectly. And then at the end of the day, again, if Murad Tabbas comes home, I mean, one thing I can tell you for sure is that when one of your loved ones is held in hellish conditions, there's a lot of emotion there.
Oh,
you can imagine what it feels like to wake up every day to wonder if your father's going to be alive, you know, at the end of the day. So these things are really, really hard. But again, we may, I'm keeping my fingers crossed, because when the Iranians are concerned, you never know. Mm-hmm. But we may have some really good news in the next couple of days.
Well, we will keep our fingers crossed and certainly get any updates as soon as they become available. And Congressman Himes, thank you so much for this. And I look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Thanks a lot, Melissa. Take care.
All right. Congressman Jim Himes here on WICC. So in recent news, there was a write-up actually in the Rolling Stone talking about toxic work environments. It was looking at the Jimmy Fallon Tonight Show. Apparently, 16 current and former staffers say Fallon's erratic behavior spoiled their dreams of working on the Tonight Show. And it kind of prompted us to talk about toxic work environments. And so Gary Fallon is back with us. He is our employment attorney here on The Morning Show to talk all about this. Hey, Gary, welcome back. How are you?
Good, Melissa. How are you?
I'm good. I have to be honest, I was kind of bummed. I'm not much of a late night talk show host fan, only because I'm always dead asleep well before. I'm like 3 hours asleep by the time they come on. So I don't watch a lot of late night talk shows. But But Jimmy Fallon was one of the ones that I actually kind of find funny, so I was a little bummed to hear about this, but I guess that's why they always say don't meet your heroes. But, you know, it's a great question about toxic work environments, whether it's fame and fortune of Jimmy Fallon or even just our everyday offices that we have here in Connecticut. Toxic work environments, they're pretty common. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. And what, you know, one of the reasons why I think something like Jimmy Fallon, why it gets some media attention is just because he has such a, you know, sunny, funny personality. We saw the same thing a few years ago with the Ellen Show,
mm-hmm.
where there
yes,
also was revelations
yes.
about a toxic work environment. What I think is unfortunate is, unlike you, Melissa, is the media doesn't take that and say, hey, is this a problem in other areas other than, you know, late night or daytime host? And I think it's a major problem. And certainly as someone who is kind of in the employment law arena, I've seen, as have others, a real increase in the rise of people saying they are in toxic work environments. And it's kind of gone under the radar to a large extent, but it is getting, certainly there's been various surveys done that show this is a real problem and it's not getting better in the short term.
Gary, in your professional opinion, why do you think it's increased? Why are more and more people saying that they have toxic work environments?
Well, I think, you know, part of it is just we have a more of a toxic society now, you know, between social media, between you know, political strife, anger, that affects also the workplace. But I think, you know, in looking at various from studies that have been done of why is this is happening, people are being asked to work harder, shorter deadlines. There's also a big increase due to technology of employee monitoring of their sort of day-to-day activities that causes stress and anxiety. There's just a also, I think there's a greater awareness of mental health issues. And that was really, you know, the COVID really was a catalyst for people saying, you know, really looking at their own lives, their own mental health and saying that is there, you know, can this be better? Is there things I should be doing that are better? That's why if you recall back in 2021, there was that period called, you know, the Great Resignation. Where 40% of people, based on surveys, were considering leaving their jobs. More people left their jobs. And it was, and a lot of that, the primary reason was seen as people working in toxic work environments. But because of what started to be the focus on mental health during that time period, people just decided to leave and do something else.
So again, Gary Fallon is here. He is our employment attorney here on The Morning Show. And we're talking about toxic work environments. How do you know, Gary, that you work in a toxic environment? Like, what are signs that this might not be the healthiest place to work?
Where there's the biggest indication is just where there's a high attrition rate. To the extent, you know, if somebody's going into a new job, is if they can try to find out what the turnover is. Once they're, you know, people are there, is there bullying behavior? I mean, 30% of people say they are bullied at work, usually, you know, some sort of abusive sort of verbal abuse. Is it pessimistic? Or is there a lot of sort of backstabbing? You know, maybe on the surface, you know, people say we're a team. A meeting ends and then they're bad-mouthing the leaders in that meeting. Those are the signs, but a lot of negativity, a lot of people who say, you know, I'm just going to do the minimum, where they're basically just trading their paycheck. They're trading their time for a paycheck. Those are all the sorts of signs that you're in a toxic work environment, you know, where people just generally don't want to go to work.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I also am wondering, Gary, do you feel like people make work too much of a priority? So I think generations ago, work was a way to be able to fund living, right? It was a way to make sure you could stay in your home, you could feed your family. But now it does feel like for a lot of people, work is their source of their entertainment, their friendships. And if it feels like we also live in a time where we do a lot of work on our phones or our laptops, which now can move with us. So you used to leave stuff in the office, but now more and more people are bringing the work home with them. Not to mention, a lot of people are working from home now. Do you think that also can tie into toxic work environments? Like, you become so invested in your job and you become almost so personable with the people you work with that sometimes, you know, lines can get crossed?
Absolutely. You know, and you're right. You know, the boundaries between work and life have dramatically changed. And that's also one of the, not just, you know, employee monitoring, but where people are expected to be sort of available all the time, weekends, mm-hmm. nights.
Exactly.
And yeah, and the, but you're right that when people draw, you know, their self-esteem way beyond just their job, but where their whole life revolves around work, that's kind of a dangerous, I mean, it's great if they love that, but it's also, you know, carries risks. And you're right, where everything, if they feel like they never leave work, even if they're home, that's a problem.
Gary Phelan is here, who is our employment attorney, and we're talking about toxic work environments. What advice, Gary, would you give to someone who's working in a toxic environment?
The primary advice really isn't legal advice. It's fire up your resume and start looking. That's because ordinarily where there's a culture of a toxic work environment, it starts at the top. And it's hard to change that if you are, you know, someone who is, you know, where there's a vast power imbalance. Now, sometimes employers have, you know, like open door policies where, you know, they encourage you to bring problems to management. If there's in that open door policy, if there's a provision that says you will not be retaliated against, then it may be worth the risk. If you really think you know, this is a place where you'd like to see it work, or if there's like one, like a supervisor in particular, then that's, you know, it's worth trying to change by going to management and seeing if it may result in change. Other than that, I would say it's probably not going to change. Life's too short. And start looking elsewhere, but don't leave until you have another position.
Yeah, certainly have that backup plan ready for you. And do you think there's any hope for change when it comes to toxic work environments, or is this sort of the name of the game? It's always been this way. You know, because I do think you made a really great point, Gary, which is that when you bring attention to things, you know, more and more that stigma kind of goes away. And I think toxic work environments, you used to just put your head down, you know, and shut up and do your job. But I feel like more and more people are outspoken about, you know, look at the strikes that we're even seeing, people saying, hey, you know what, the way that we're paid and the way that we're treated is unfair. So I do think we're starting to see a shift in the way people speak up about their workplaces. But toxicity in the workplace, do you think that will ever go away?
Despite the otherwise bleak commentary from me, I'm actually optimistic. And the big thing is what you put your finger on, which is greater awareness. You can't solve a problem until you know you have a problem. And I don't think this was really recognized as a problem. The other, I think, encouraging sign is the younger generation. Mental health is a major priority. And so, you know, if somebody wants to keep those younger workers, then you need to start addressing the problem because they're not going to tolerate it. Because there is such a, you know, and that's one of the areas where I think social media has actually been helpful. There's less of a stigma about people saying they're depressed, that they are just suffering stress and they're taking time off and that kind of thing. There's a much greater use of mental health professionals. I think also there's a recognition that, you know, often in a workplace where it percolates to the top, where we got a problem here, the way to solve it was, you know, give them more money or let's have Friday afternoon happy hours. And that's it. That there has to be more steps taken internally to address those problems Many of them are inexpensive, like greater recognition for employees, the big factor. But and I think it, part of it is also generational. I came up in a generation where, you know, working hard was seen as a tremendous quality, even if it was at the expense of your personal life, your family life. That was, it was almost an expectation if you wanted to get ahead. Now there's a recognition that that has consequences. And so you're seeing, and I'm looking, you know, like in the legal profession, where more and more law firms are setting up committees on wellness. You know, I'm co-chair of the Greater Bridgeport Bar Association Committee on the Profession. We're planning a conference on wellness. It's affecting the bottom line. And that's where I think you will see change, where people, employers, see the cost of attrition that it's taking on them, they have to make this a priority. So I'm actually very optimistic, but it doesn't mean we're not going to go through a painful period to get to that point where the optimism is realized.
Well, Gary, I appreciate your insight on this. And again, it's something that does impact many, many people. And certainly we hope to continue to see more changes ahead. Thank you so much. And we will talk again soon.
Thanks, Melissa.
All right. And that's Gary Phelan again here, our employment attorney on WICC. We love highlighting the University of Bridgeport and the amazing work that they are doing. And so today I want to introduce you to Dr. Tim Rayner. How dare I? I didn't even say doctor when you came in. I'm so sorry. Terrible. But Tim is here, and he is the director and associate professor for the School of Business over at UB, and we welcome him in studio. Hey, Tim, how are you?
Good morning, and thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about UB.
I'm excited to have you here, and I've noticed you and I were kind of talking in the commercial break that UB continues to really put itself in the limelight. It keeps ending up in the news. It keeps ending up on my news desk, I've noticed. Tell us a little bit about why that is. What is UB doing?
So, as you know, in Fairfield County, we're the little guy.
Mm-hmm.
And the little guy has to work harder, be smarter, be more creative, design student experiences that attract students to our campus. We have a beautiful campus. We actually have dorm rooms that look out over the ocean, right? So we've got curb appeal. We got great professors, great programs.
Mm-hmm.
But we spend a lot of time really thinking about the student and how we can design experiences, degrees, credentials that make them career ready.
Mm-hmm. And with the School of Business, I mean, that's a tough, very competitive, because so many schools offer a School of Business. What makes UB's like unique? What makes you stand out?
So with that in mind, all of my professors have industry experience. So my CPA professor, my accounting professor, is a CPA. So in the spring semester, we run, it's called the VITA Clinic. Our accounting students do real tax returns for real people. And so having industry professors teach makes it real, career readiness. So there aren't a lot of schools in Connecticut that do a VITA Clinic. We're one of them. And we have professors that use their industry contacts for jobs, internships, projects. We work really, really hard at designing unique student experiences that help them to be career ready.
Because when they go and they apply for those careers after college, unless it's, you know, some schools will have, you know, internships lined up or something like that, but they're actually going with work experience. So they're going with that credibility already attached to their name, essentially. UB provides that.
Exactly. For example, we have a finance program, graduate finance program. Graduate finance students participated in a global community commodity challenge. So universities from all over the United States and all over the world put together teams. Our team, going into the last weekend of this month-long competition, out of 500 teams, 70 countries, we are in first place.
Wow.
At the end of the competition, when they backed out the commissions that would have occurred in real commodity trading, our kids came in second place in the world. So now that student graduates with an MS in finance, and they go to their first job interview. And they have, yes, I have a degree in finance. Yes, I got my Bloomberg certificate at the University of Bridgeport. But, oh, by the way, I participated in this challenge. And that software that you have, Mr. Employer, I've worked on it. The things that you demand, I've done that. So if we design unique experiences, we can position our students and have them better prepared for the real world.
And what a unique time to have that, Tim. And the reason I say that is because we're seeing such a big shift since COVID with the way the workplace works. And it's kind of a, you know, like in real estate, we say it's a seller's market. Right now, it is an employee's market. You know, you are looking for people. It's, you kind of have the pick of the litter, might I say. Mm-hmm. And when you have students who are not just saying like, oh, I witnessed or I took a, you know, people will do internships and that's fine. And you know, you're getting coffee for them. You're viewing, you're taking it in. Okay, you got job experience. But when you actually have tangible experience you are handing to your future employer, all of a sudden, you know, they say all the time, it doesn't matter the name of the university. What are you bringing to the table? What are you bringing to my place of work? Your students are bringing that tangible, you know, I would say proof that they can handle the jobs, which is extraordinary. And I'm wondering what made the shift with UB? Because I think that UB was always, again, kind of like it was almost looked at as, and I don't mean this in a harsh way, but it was almost looked at as like a Housatonic, almost like it was a community. But I find UB is a competitive university. When did you see that shift happen?
So when you start doing a competitive analysis, mm-hmm. and, you know, how can we differentiate the school of business? It evolved over the last couple of years, this theme of career readiness. And, mm-hmm. and so, for example, my undergraduate degree program, yes, you'll get a BS in accounting, but in that degree experience, you'll also get a Bloomberg certificate, which is an industry certificate. You'll also get Google Analytics certificate. You'll also get a project management certificate. You'll also get a Hootsuite marketing certificate. So you'll get industry credentials built into your degree program, and an internship is mandatory. So competitively, we know that we work harder than the people we're competing with, and so we have to work harder for our students to be successful. And career readiness is the key. They want to step into the workforce, and if we can help them, then we're doing our job.
And they're more confident, I would think. Now, I'm curious, Tim, do you find, you know, I know, again, this has only been a couple of years, but do you find that your recent graduates, they're thriving?
So it's really interesting. At the University of Bridgeport, and I'll give you, for example, the previous president at Nestle USA Waters is a UB alum. The president of the Toronto Football Club is a UB alum. I have students that are industry presidents and working at the Corner Bank and everything in between. One of our grads is at BlackRock, the largest hedge fund in the world. So what we're doing is creating an environment where students can be successful. If they want to engage, then we have something for them. We're launching a coffee business. Think about how crazy that is, right? If you go to medical school, you work in a real hospital. So why shouldn't our students run a real business? So October 1st, graduate international students have spent the last year building a coffee business. A real business, you know, it's not Girl Scout cookies. It's a real business, mm-hmm. and it's going to launch. And so they've figured out how to get coffee from Guatemala, how to get it roasted, how to get it packaged. They've set up the banking, the pricing, the marketing. And so Purple Nights Coffee is going to launch October 1st. So again, when that student goes for a job interview, yes, they have the degree. Yes, they did an internship. And then, oh, by the way,
we opened a business.
I was the operations manager and figured out how to get coffee from Guatemala to Bridgeport, Connecticut, to you, the consumer.
That's amazing. And by the way, when that coffee shop opens, I'd love to have somebody on the show. We should definitely promote that. Just saying. That's
absolutely
very cool. I love that. We have Tim Rayner here, Dr. Tim Rayner. I have to. Come on now. I know. I'm embarrassing him. But I love this model of teaching at UB, and I'm so glad that we're talking about this. And Tim is the director of the School of Business over at UB, and you guys have a symposium coming up next week. In fact, I believe it is a week from this, from, I think, today. Let me just see. Let me double check. I believe it is, though. Let's
yes.
see. It's the 22nd, right? Yes. Okay.
Yes.
My math is not that great. That's why I talk for a living. So 1 week from today, you guys have a very big symposium happening. First of all, what is it?
So incorporated in the theme of student experiences, we have a sport management program. So students from the sport management program are currently taking an event management course. So we have some very high profile alumni and some very high profile contacts. And so we've asked the students to organize an event. So next Friday from 1 to 3 on campus at 230 Park Avenue, Mandeville, in Mandeville 107, we have a symposium. And it's just a conversation. So Bill Manning is the president of the Toronto Football Club and the Toronto Argonauts. He's one of our alumni. Brendan Donahue is the president of NBA 2K, one of the largest gaming platforms in the world that's owned by the NBA. And John Matsky works for the Islanders, is one of their senior executives with the Islanders. And so the idea is have our students run an event, practical experience, but more importantly, have them exposed to real industry professionals. Mm-hmm. The moderator of the event is one of our graduate analytics students. He's a scholarship basketball player from Japan, and he's an amazing young man. And so the students set it up, the students moderate it, and we just get to sit back and enjoy what they've built.
That's amazing. And this is happening a week from today, and it's happening on campus. Why have the students run this? And I think going back to what we were talking about, which is really getting the students in, you know, knee deep into understanding if this is even what they want to do once they graduate. What comes out of an experience like putting together the symposium?
So the majority of the sport management students will either end up working with a team, working with a facility, things like that. And so using project management software, figuring out, you know, doing all the details. Does the microphone, is the room booked, confirm with the talent, all of that stuff. It's a very linear process. And to make them do it, really do it, and not read a book and just answer something, but do, you know, experiential learning, project-based learning, that's the highest level of learning, when they can do something with an outcome, not read a chapter with an outcome. Mm. So that's the whole concept, project-based learning, let them dive in, get their hands dirty, make mistakes, and learn. You know, I always say, as faculty, we're the training wheels. They're the bike. They pedal, they steer. Our job in project-based learning is when they lean too far to the left or lean too far to the right, we're there to balance them back up. Mm-hmm. So this is one of those. Ricky Spears is the professor of the class. And so it's his class that's coming in, and they're going to be working the event.
I think that's so great. And again, that symposium is happening next Friday, and it's the School of Business is going to be hosting what's called the Business of Sports Symposium, and it is going to be student-run, which is really cool. Students in UB's event management course hosting a Q&A event with three major players in both athletics and esports, the esports world, I should say, to discuss the business of sports and all of that. And Tim, I think my last question for you, at least for today, because I would love to have you come back on the show and talk more about this, is what is your, you know, as you go into each academic year, I would think that you probably build new goals because that's, I think, what naturally people do, you know, at any job. But what is your focus, your goal for the School of Business? What would you like to see added on to what is already growing success with UB?
Student success. Every year, our students change, the external environment changes, the employment dynamics in the workplace, everything changes every single year. If we focus on student success, then we as a School of Business adapt to the changes. This year, single largest program is my analytics program. 5 years ago, it wasn't. We didn't have analytics. Mm. So we have to adapt. And who is the graduate student? What do they need to be career ready? And if we always focus on student success, then we will always adapt to the environment to make sure the students are successful.
Off the cuff, I'm just trying to think, or even just for the School of Business, how many students does UB have?
So about 4,200.
Right.
The university.
I love that it's kind of a smaller school because I think there's a better focus.
And, you know, it's we have to focus on the student, our service level, our communication level, our engagement level, because we're the little guy in the neighborhood, we have to work harder, smarter, and be more creative.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it seems like you're doing that, which is really amazing. And again, Tim Rayner, who is the director and associate professor for the School of Business over at the University of Bridgeport, I want to thank you for coming in studio. I thank you for having these goals and these visions and making them come to life for so many students. And I am excited to continue to watch it happen at UB. So thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Absolutely. And again, that symposium is happening next Friday. And we'll certainly keep a very close eye on the School of Business at UB because they're doing some pretty great stuff. We were just celebrating the fall. Why are we going to Christmas? I have a very good reason. I mean, like, the best reason. It's because we have the Trans-Siberian Orchestra back on WICC. Jeff Plait is back with us. I love talking to Jeff every single season because I get excited for the holidays, and I certainly get excited for this incredible orchestra. Jeff is one of the drummers and also the original member from the TSO, and he is back on the show with us right now. Jeff, welcome back to WICC, and I guess Merry Early Christmas. How are you?
Thank you, Melissa. Appreciate it.
I love having you on each and every year, and I love the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. First of all, for people who are not familiar, I don't know how, maybe they're living under a rock, but tell us a little bit about TSO, how long it's been around, and what you guys are all about.
There are still a number of people that when you say the name, they really don't connect it until you hum that song, until you hum that melody, and they go, oh yeah, I know you guys. But yes, we've had a very interesting run through all these years, starting back in 1995 when we were first recorded Christmas Eve Sarajevo 1224, and this was the brainchild of Paul O'Neill, the late great Paul O'Neill, and this song became a vehicle for Paul to create the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. We did our first record in 1996. We did our first touring in 1999. Excuse me, and things have just gotten bigger and better every year. So here we are heading off on our tour for 2023. It's going to be another fantastic tour. And for those of you who have seen us before, you know what TSO is and what you're going to get. And for those of you that haven't, please give us a shot because there really is something in this show for everybody. It's probably one of the most unique shows that you'll ever see.
I joke about this with you every year, Jeff, but I always say this is what sealed the deal for my brother getting his wife, because one of their first dates was a concert at you know, one of your concerts. And after that, I think they got engaged like maybe a month or two later. I might be exaggerating, but I do remember when they first were dating and he's like, I'm going to take her to Trans-Siberian Orchestra. And I thought, what? Wow, you must really like this girl. And it was like not too long after that they ended up getting married. And it really is a magical experience. Tell people, sort of bring us in to the concert hall. Tell us what it is like to take, take in one of your shows.
Well, there's, excuse me, a little bit of everything. I mean, Paul O'Neill created something for the masses. He wanted... I mean, even years before TSO was officially created, Paul had the idea for this group in his mind to create something that was going to cover all musical genres, that was going to involve a story, that was going to involve theater, that was going to involve, you know, an amazing production and performance. And that's exactly what TSO is. Now, for people who have never seen us before, or maybe never even heard us before, if you come to our show, you will recognize a number of the classic holiday themes and melodies that Paul weaved in and out of his original songs. So there's something recognizable throughout our show for everybody. But along with that, you have a story, as I mentioned. You have a narrator. You've got this holiday setting and this holiday mood. And at its core, TSO is a rock band. You know, most of us came from a rock background, as did Paul O'Neill. And add that along with the holiday vibe to one of the biggest and best productions that you're ever going to see on the road. And boy, it's hard to explain really what this is until you actually sit in the room and see the show. Mm-hmm. But there is so much emotion. There are so many ups and downs in the show. It's such a great energy. You know, there's nothing but positivity in the show that we put on. There's nothing but positivity in Paul's lyrics and Paul's story. So add that to an incredible band, incredible vocalists, a light show and stage performance like you will never see anywhere. It truly is amazing. But from our humble beginnings back in 1999, when we had one box truck with a couple dozen lights.
I can't even imagine that. That's crazy.
It was so awesome. But now we come into town with 20 tractor trailers full of lighting and sound, and that's just how much this thing has grown, and that's how big our production is. But it's truly awesome.
That's amazing. And again, we have Jeff Plate here, who is from the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. He's the drummer and actually an original member of the orchestra, and the work that they do is just incredible, and it has grown so much over the past couple of decades. They've been around since the mid-90s, and this year, the TSO tour is called The Ghosts of Christmas Eve, the Best of TSO and More, which promises to be a new and larger presentation of the beloved holiday tradition, which is the Ghosts of Christmas Eve, which really captured the hearts of multiple generations. And I want to talk about that aspect, Jeff. How do you guys do that? How do you attract people from as young as 5 years old to 95 years old? Hmm. How do you do that? It's a hard thing to do.
It certainly is. And I think it was just part of Paul's formula in style. You know, here again, I mentioned Paul incorporated these holiday themes into these songs. So here again, whether you're young or old, that's something that connects with you. But the main thing is, to me, is the story. You know, Paul wrote some beautiful stories around these albums that we released. And the very first album, Christmas Eve and Other Stories, which came out in 1996, you know, we toured that particular album for 12 years straight. And that story in particular, I think, really just connected with everybody in the room. And from the very first shows that we did early on when we started touring, people started realizing, wow, you know, there's a really good message here. This is a fun show. This is actually a family show. I can bring my children. I can bring my grandparents. My metalhead teenager is going to dig this, you know, everybody in between. So Paul covered all the bases when it came to this. But here again, as word spread, more people started coming into the shows. The show then got bigger. So, you know, a lot of people come to see us for all of the above, but, you know, one of the main attractions really is the performance. And as I mentioned, when you sit in the room, you get what we do. It's kind of hard to explain, but it is very intense. It's very loud and heavy at times. It's very soft and beautiful at times, and everything in between. So, like I said, people figured out this was a family show. And once that happened, this audience for this project just grew so fast. We went from doing theaters in 1999 to small arenas a couple years later to selling out major arenas twice a day a few years after that. And my head was spinning. I remember walking on stage in a couple places thinking, I can't believe what's going on here. This is just unreal. But here we are, you know, all these years later, and it is still going strong and still getting bigger every year.
Yeah, and this year, wow, you've got 104 concerts this season in 62 cities in just 46 days, if you could figure out the math there. We're just geeking out over here. I know, it might feel like it's a little too soon for the holiday season and Christmas and all of that, but come on now. When Jeff Plate of the Trans-Siberian Orchestra calls you, you're not going to be like, oh, call back in a couple months. No, get out of here with that. That's crazy. What's wrong with you? Come on now. Jeff, I love whenever I get to talk to you. And I know that the TSO is going to be back in Connecticut is one of the stops that you're going to be making in your upcoming season. And we'll get to that in just a second. Again, 104 concerts, 62 cities, 46 days. I have no idea how you're doing it. But before we get to that, I want to talk about the fact that TSO, I'm not sure if people know this, you donate at least a dollar from every ticket sold to local charities. And you've actually given more than $18 million over the years to worthy charities throughout North America. That's extraordinary. Why does that matter to TSO, and which charities are benefiting?
So this was something that Paul O'Neill instituted from the very first ticket that we ever sold back in 1999. And his thought with this was, you know, it's a small gesture of thanks to the cities and the communities that invite us in to do what we do. But it was also, you know, in his mind, this time of year is a wonderful time for a lot of people, and it is certainly difficult for many others. And this was just a small token, you know, just a small way to help us help somebody out. And as you mentioned, $18 million plus. It has added up over the years, but this also involves everybody in the audience. You know, everybody that's in the room is involved in helping out somebody in their community and possibly somebody they even know. So, you know, it's just possibly something that's going to put a smile on somebody's face or help them get back on their feet. But you know, Paul insisted on this from the word go. We lost Paul several years ago, but, you know, his family stepped right up. You know, first and foremost, the charity stays. We're going to continue to do this because we're just helping too many people, and this is something that we need to do. But, hey, you know, before you know it, it's going to be $20 million, and it'll probably be close to that after this year's tour. But it's something we're all very, very proud of. Every year I do these interviews and talk about this and look at that number, it's like, man, it's just amazing how much – not only, you know, we bring a lot of joy to people during these shows and people have listened to our music, but when you look at that and think of all the people that you've helped, and it's everything from children's hospitals to blood banks, to food banks, to zoos, you know, everything in between. And to answer your question about, you know, which charity gets chosen, that's usually the promoting radio station and the promoter, I believe. I'm not exactly sure how some of these are chosen, but there's such a variety of them, and we know that they all need the help, and we're more than happy to help them out.
I love that. I think that's very, very neat. And again, we have Jeff here from TSO, the Trans-Siberian Orchestra, and they are going to be going on their next tour, the 2023 tour. And it does include a stop here in Connecticut. In fact, it's the Sunday after Thanksgiving. You're going to be back at Mohegan Sun having two shows that day. Can I just say really quickly, I have no idea how you guys are knocking this out so smoothly. You literally do like a ping pong, it seems like, effect, but it's amazing. So you're going to go from, it looks like, Worcester, Mass, down to Mohegan Sun, so not too bad. Because I know, are there two TSOs? Like, is there one on the West Coast and one on the East Coast? Is that how you guys are able to knock this out? Because it's pretty unbelievable.
Yes, exactly. And that's, you know, there's no way we could cover this ground unless we had two different groups. And it's interesting because in 1999, when we did our first tour, it was only seven shows.
Wow.
And the idea was, well, let's put this thing on stage and see if people like this. And then the next year, I think that there was 70 requests.
Wow.
For shows.
I believe
And at the time, we were trying to do this tour between Thanksgiving and Christmas Eve. So it was even a shorter window of time than what we have now.
That's insane.
And Paul O'Neill and his team said, well, let's take the original group, split it in two, we'll fill out the cast. And this way we can cover more ground if we have two groups. We do identical set lists. It's identical production. Obviously, you know, different members on stage, so there's a different personality, there's a different vibe for some songs and things like that. But this is how we've been running ever since the year 2000. And, you know, we, even still, if you cut that number in half, we are still doing eight shows in 5 days every week, three double show days, you know, every Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And it is a lot of work in a short amount of time, but, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah, no, it's crazy, Jeff. Absolutely. I have no clue how you do what you do. So it's just amazing. Now, I've never asked you this in all the years that we've talked to on the radio together. Which group are you part of? Are you the West Coast or are you East Coast?
No, I'm East Coast.
Yay!
When the split was made.
Oh my Lord!
When the split was made.
I got nervous.
Yeah.
I got nervous. Okay.
Myself and myself and Chris Caffrey have been on the East Coast from the beginning. Al Petrelli, Johnny Middleton, they went out to the West Coast. And it's pretty much stayed like that ever since we did the split. But, hey, you know, it works out. And each band has its own personality. Each band has its own fan base, you know. And there are places, there are cities in the Midwest where things kind of cross over once in a while. So people actually get to see both groups, and I think that's pretty cool.
It is really cool. And again, the Trans-Siberian Orchestra is going to be making their stop here in Connecticut the Sunday after Thanksgiving, which is perfect. They've got two shows that day, 3 o'clock and 8 o'clock. I think I'm going to try to snag tickets for the 3 o'clock and finally take. Our five-year-old is just – he's so he loves music, but he's just gotten to the point where he could sit through a whole show, like a live show. We took him to James Taylor earlier this summer, and he got through the whole – I mean, he stayed till the encore, which was – I couldn't believe it. But I think this is finally the year. Yeah, he loves live music, but he loves especially orchestra, string. We just had we just watched a quartet, I should say, about a week ago, and he was mesmerized. I mean, just sitting there for an hour and a half, just loves it. So I think this is the year for him. Now, the tickets start to go on sale, actually, as of this morning. 10 o'clock this morning, and it looks like there are special prices of $39 tickets even being offered for either 1 week only or until supplies last. Where can people get their tickets, Jeff? Because I'm going to be there at 10.
Yeah, go right to our website, www.trans-siberian.com. That's the best place to do it. There's so many other outlets and things you find online. Yeah, this looks legitimate. And, you know, it's a lot of them aren't. So go right to our website. That'll take you right to Ticketmaster, and that's probably the best and safest way to do it.
All right. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for always making the time to come on WICC. I love connecting with you, and hopefully I will finally get to maybe I'll get to meet you in November. I'll try to pull some strings and see if I could come see you, but I know you're busy, so I'm excited to at least see the show right after Thanksgiving. That'll be so exciting here in Connecticut.
Sounds good, Melissa. Hope to see you soon.
All right. Jeff Plate, again, who is one of the original members of the Trans-Siberian Orchestra and the drummer right here for the East Coast TSO. I'm so excited to see them, hopefully. And if you want to grab some tickets as well, they go on sale as early as 10 o'clock this morning. Just go to their website. And they've even gotten some special deals right now until supplies last.